KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an assistant professor of law at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me on the show today. Today I'm excited to have on Professor Kevin Werbach of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania discussing his article, which has recently come out in the Duke Law Journal, called The Network Utility. And we're going to use that article, which focuses on how we should view the Internet and the FCC's role in it by analogy to how the FCC and how the law has dealt with utilities more broadly in the past. But we're going to use that article as a jumping off point for discussion of, I think, three core issues which we've discussed on Hearsay Culture with a variety of guests over the last couple of years. The first, broadly, is the network neutrality debate, a debate which has been ongoing for quite a while, a term which was coined by Professor Tim Wu, who's been on the show a couple of times, and has focused on how and whether we should prioritize information as it travels through the Internet. This idea of having information not have priority, or indeed have priority, depending on your perspective, and what that means for communications more broadly. We're also going to discuss some history involved with how the FCC has regulated communications. Kevin's article discusses some cases which I think many people have forgotten about, if they ever knew about them at all, from the 50s and 60s that focused on early efforts to regulate computers and more broadly communications. And so we're going to talk about that a bit, and also we're going to discuss this idea of the cloud. This is a term which has become front and center over the last couple of years, and we're going to discuss what that means, whether it has relevance, and particularly what the cloud means for purposes of regulation. So I'm very excited to have Kevin on today. We are recording the show on Friday, May 20th, and the show is going to air this coming Tuesday. By way of brief background, Kevin is an associate professor of legal studies and business ethics at the Wharton School. He's the founder of the Supernova Group, a technology analysis and consulting firm. He also co-led the review of the Federal Communications Commission for the Obama-Biden transition project. He's written a number of law review articles. He's also appeared in a variety of print and television and radio media. He is a graduate of Harvard Law School, as well as a graduate of UC Berkeley. Kevin is joining us from his home via Skype in Philadelphia. Kevin, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thanks very much for having me, Dave.
Kevin, I asked this question of most of my guests, and I'll ask you the same question. How did you become interested broadly in the topic of the FCC and its regulation of the Internet? What's your background, and how did you develop that interest there?
Largely by accident. I was always interested in technology as a hobby. My major in college at Cal, as you mentioned, was a double major in Soviet studies and Slavic literature. And then in 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed. And as I was thinking about what to do, I always had this interest in technology. I had done desktop publishing. I had a computer fairly early on. And I went to law school and had a wonderful experience in law school and graduated in 1994. Which, in hindsight, was the real birth year of the commercial internet. It was when Netscape really burst on the scene, and the internet as we know it today was taking root. And I didn't want to go to a law firm. I wanted to do something that used the technology that I loved in some way. But there really wasn't cyber law per se at that point. There were a few people like Larry Lessig running around talking about this stuff. But it didn't exist as a discipline, and out in the real world, there were very few opportunities. So I poked around. I almost became the general counsel of Wired magazine. I almost went to work for the Electronic Frontier Foundation, which was around at that point. And then I saw a notice at the law school that the Federal Communications Commission was hiring people that year out of law school. And this was back in the day when Al Gore was going around talking about the information superhighway. The Clinton administration had what was called the National Information Infrastructure Project. And I thought, great, this will be an opportunity to go employ what I know about technology and merge it with my legal training And I can go learn about everything that's happening and go to a place where there are lots of people working on this idea of the internet as really the future of communications. So I got to the FCC, and it turned out that there was hardly anyone there who was really thinking about the internet as the future of communications, because at that point they were thinking about these forgotten things like video dial tone and these big commercial systems, things like CompuServe and Prodigy and what Microsoft was doing. That was the focus. The internet was in some ways the afterthought. But to my great fortune, Reed Hundt, who was the chairman of the FCC at that time, was really quite a visionary on understanding the importance of technology. There was Vice President Gore and a number of others in the White House who appreciated how epical the internet was. And there were some other folks at the FCC as well. And because I had this some amount of knowledge and interest in the area, even though I was the new guy, I showed up not really knowing much or anything about communications law, I became the internet guy at the FCC. And so when, for example, in 1995, a group of long-distance telephone resellers petitioned the FCC to regulate voice over IP out of existence, it landed on my desk because I was the internet guy. And that started a process getting involved both at the FCC and then across the Clinton administration through Ira Magaziner's Electronic Commerce Project to explore just what the internet meant for communications law and more broadly for our legal system in a variety of areas. So at every turn, it's not been planned for me. It's been somewhat by accident, but it's just been tremendously exciting to watch this field as it grows and try and keep up with it.
Yeah, positioning is so important as people build their careers, and it seems like, particularly with regard to the internet and getting involved at the early stages as you did, that being in the right place played an enormous role. And it's an interesting role because having spent as much time as you've had with the FCC, perhaps I'll ask this question as a jumping off point before we even get into the details of your article. The FCC has been, as you know, under enormous attack as being captured by various interests that have an interest in seeing regulation at the FCC go a certain way. And, of course, regulatory capture is nothing new. That's not a new concept, and I think all agencies have to deal with it. From your perspective, having worked inside the FCC and today, what's your critique of that concern? This is the Nigel Pound gorilla in the room, which I'll ask up front. Is the FCC capable with dealing with the various interests that go in front of them asking questions about the internet?
So, yes, absolutely. It's certainly capable, and we've seen lots of times over the past 15 years where the FCC has been very bold and very forward-looking and played an important supporting role in facilitating the growth of the internet, both as a commercial phenomenon, but also as an open platform for innovation and for culture and for everything else. And I certainly wouldn't say that what the FCC has done has been perfect, and I certainly wouldn't say that the FCC can or should or does claim primary responsibility for what's happened predominantly through private sector activity and lots of individual innovation. But that being said, there were plenty of opportunities for the FCC to screw it up. I gave one example. There was a petition that was filed, which legally on its face was quite credible, that essentially said, following the statute that Congress gave the FCC, voice over IP services should be subject to all of the rules that apply to traditional telephone companies, all of the requirements they pay into subsidy systems, all of the at that point pricing requirements and so forth, and that would have strangled VOIP in the butt. We would not be having this call over Skype, I assure you, had the FCC made the wrong decision there. And there were some interests, namely all the regulated interests, who were supportive of that view at that point. And the FCC didn't go in that direction, I think, rightly. So it's certainly always a legitimate concern that regulators could be captured. There have been very persuasive critiques from you know, a number of scholars about the regulatory process in general and the FCC in particular. And there have been times where I've been very critical of the agency, but it's just an oversimplification to say that you know, the chairman is in the pocket of such and such company, or the agency just does what this industry wants. That's really not how government works. And again, while there are always exceptions, you know, in my extensive dealings with the last four FCC chairmen and hundreds of FCC staff the last 15 years, the overwhelming majority of them get up and go to work every day thinking about how they can do the right thing for the American people. Now, we may have differences of opinion about what that is and differences on policy, but it's not thinking about corporate interests. The way the FCC is set up, though, mm-hmm. most of the things that it deals with day to day are about clashes of different industry factions. So I'll get to the internet in a sec. In some ways, that's the exception at times. But many of the issues the FCC deal with come down to an issue where the cable industry, for example, has one perspective on what the rules should be, and the telephone industry has a different perspective. Or when I was there, the big fight was the local telephone companies versus the long-distance telephone companies. Now, that division really no longer exists today. But back then, that was a big issue. And public interest groups played an important role in the process, but it wasn't typically a debate like you see in some other regulatory contexts, say the EPA, where you've got industry on one side that's interested in lax restrictions on pollution and environmental groups on the other side who are interested in stronger regulation. So it's sort of a different process, and it's and the kind of capture analysis doesn't quite cover it. The internet's interesting because the question is who's on the side of the internet. And my perspective has always been that ultimately everyone is on the side of the internet, that industries that think that it's in their interest to restrain the growth of the open internet are being very short-sighted and will ultimately harm themselves. And that's played out in terms of what we've seen from, for example, the music industry and also from some of the communications companies. They're starting to realize that they are internet companies and the growing openness and creativity of the internet actually helps them. But sometimes that's not the perception. And so there certainly have been times when there has not been a strong enough force on the side of the open internet. Namely, there was a period between when competition collapsed in local telephone service and the technology firms like Google and Microsoft and so forth realized that they needed to play an active role in the policy process at the FCC, where there was something of a vacuum. But most of the time, that's more about the balance of interest. It's not so much about capture. If you want to, I could say much more about the nitty gritty of mechanics at the FCC. The reality is it's more complicated, and the problem, and that gets to what I talked about in this paper, is less the inherent capability of the FCC than the kind of legal constraints it's under, the political constraints it's under, and the box that it's built for itself over the last couple of decades in terms of how it thinks about these issues.
Yeah, and I think that's, you know, that's, Kevin, where, you know, where we want to head, because, you know, as you mentioned, there are structural impediments both self-imposed as well as imposed from the outside that limit some of the FCC's abilities, and perhaps that's where we need to go as we get into your paper. Perhaps and so I'm going to take you up on that offer to discuss the structure of the FCC in a bit more detail. You know, we hear about the FCC, we talk about the FCC, but I don't think there's a lot of understanding of how it actually operates. So perhaps you could talk about that at a top level to get us into a discussion of what you mean by network utility.
Sure. So the basic description is the FCC is an independent regulatory agency, which means within the U.S. Federal government, it's technically not part of the executive branch. It's not part of, in this case, the Obama administration. The president appoints or nominates the commissioners, and the president selects which of them is the chairman. Those then get confirmed by the Senate, but the commissioners have to be split, so typically three from one party, that's the majority party, and two from the other party. And the FCC has its own independent authority subject to Congress. So Congress, in passing legislation, defines the scope of the FCC's legal authority. Now, there are lots of conversations and relationships between the FCC and the White House all the time. But technically, the FCC is set up to be the independent expert regulator. And it was set up back in 1934, and the predecessor, the Federal Radio Commission, went back even before that, because of an understanding that these technical issues require expertise. They have enormous public policy ramifications, but they require a depth of understanding that for which it helps to have a bureaucracy in the good sense, to have people who are not just political appointees or not just people involved in the legislative process, but people who develop a deep understanding of, for example, the mechanics of spectrum auctions. The FCC has some of the world's experts in creating spectrum auctions, which are extraordinarily technically complex and difficult to set up, or some of these deep issues about communications regulation. They require that kind of long-term perspective and expertise. So that's how the FCC is set up. It has five commissioners who exercise policymaking authority, and then it has a series of bureaus which deal with particular kinds of issues. And this gets to some of the difficulty. The bureaus are set up in the same way as the FCC's statute, the Communications Act, is set up, which is by technology. So they have what's now called the Wireline Competition Bureau, which basically was created to deal with telephone service, but wired telephone service, because when it was set up, that was the only thing. Then they have separately a Wireless Bureau that deals with wireless telephone service and other kinds of wireless service. And then they have an International Bureau, which, among other things, deals with satellite service, because that was not within the purview of wireless telecommunications. They have a Cable Bureau to deal with cable television. They have a Media Bureau to deal with television and radio and other kinds of media services. And then they have a few other bureaus and offices. And this structure allows the FCC to operate functionally. The vast majority of what the FCC does day-to-day, most people are totally unaware of. It's routine processing that's important, for example, to ensure that wireless devices don't emit wireless radiation in the wrong way. You wouldn't want to have a mobile phone that is dangerous personally, or that's going to interfere with the navigation systems of an airplane. Mm-hmm. So the FCC deals with just certification of mobile devices. It deals with a whole bunch of routine stuff. Some of it's Congress. One of the things the Congress mandates the FCC do is indecency regulation of content on broadcasting. I tend to think, and frankly, there are many people within the FCC who tend to think that that's a business it should be much less involved in, but that's something that it's statutorily mandated to do. So there's this whole series of bureaus and series of tasks the FCC has. Many of the ones that I look at have to deal with the regulation of the communications industry, which again goes back to a whole series of detailed provisions put into place in the 1934 Communications Act and then substantially revised in 1996 when Congress overhauled the law.
We're chatting with Professor Kevin Warbeck of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania on KCSU FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. Kevin, with that background, we can get into a discussion of your article and then more broadly some of these issues that I mentioned in the introduction. You have this article which has recently come out in Duke Law Journal, as I mentioned, called The Network Utility, which of course begs the question, what is a network utility? And I think this also, again, gets to the structural and legal issues involving the FCC. So what do you mean, as a jumping off point into the article, by that phrase, network utility?
Well, to paraphrase the old Saturday Night Live skit, a network utility is both a network and a utility. Talk amongst yourselves. This article comes from it pulls together a number of threads of things that I've done and also some discoveries that I just made along the way of researching other projects. But I've been interested for a long time in the concept of networks, not just in communications regulation, in terms of networks as a paradigm for understanding the essence of the world we live in. I teach at a business school, so I'm very interested not just in law, but in the evolution of business as well as in the evolution of society. And I like to talk about the fact that we're living in a network age, where networked connectivity, the fact that everyone is linked together through these digital communications platforms, defines and enables so much of the important phenomena in today's world. So I've been interested in networks for a while, and I've also, of course, been interested in regulation. And what got me increasingly frustrated was the sense that for many years in telecom policy, we've been going down a rat hole. We've been struggling with these increasingly fine and vague and complicated distinctions between different terms in the statute. So you mentioned network neutrality. There's been this intense debate at the FCC actively since 2002, so 8-9 years now, and it has roots going before that, about how and whether the FCC should adopt rules on internet access providers and in particular broadband access providers. And it's often come down to a very difficult, convoluted process to determine what's a telecommunications service versus an information service under the statute and what that means in different categories and so forth. So I've increasingly been frustrated and had the sense that the whole debate is broken. And so I started to look back to some of the antecedents and to try to understand, well, just forget about the specifics for a minute. What are we doing here? What is the mission of government? Why do we need government? And what is it about this set of areas that might suggest government has a different role? To come back to your point about regulatory capture, I do think it's appropriate, even though in these debates I tend to be someone who advocates a role for the FCC, I do think it's appropriate to start and say our assumption going in should always be that if the market can work, then we should let the market work and not try to have some regulators decide on their own what the right outcome is. So the question is, why is the internet and communications a field that has a need for this regulatory structure? And that comes down to the fact that it's about networks and it's about utilities. And networks, it turns out, have particular characteristics. And I've done some other work that leverages a whole area of scientific discourse called network science, where researchers have studied the fundamental properties of networks. And that, I think, teaches us some lessons about why there's a need for government to play a role to facilitate the flourishing of networks. And that there are certain kinds of businesses that play a distinct role in society, which we call utilities. And utilities, we usually think about things like electric power companies and so forth. But we also traditionally have thought about phone companies and other communications companies as utilities. And so I started to look back at the history of some of those ideas, and I started coming across these funny references back in the 60s to something called the computer utility. And I would like to think of myself as an expert in at least U.S. communications regulation and U.S. internet policy, and I had never heard of this before. When I learned the history of the FCC's intersection with computers, it generally started in the 1970s, as did the history of the internet. It started with ARPANET in 1969 and then the evolution to the NSFNet through the 1970s. Mm-hmm. And here I started seeing these articles from the mid-60s that clearly weren't talking about the internet because there was no internet. And they were talking about the FCC regulating computers, and they had this concept called the computer utility. And I thought, wow, what the hell is this? This is something interesting. And so that was, in a way, the genesis of this project.
And it's interesting before we get into a break that, you know, as you mentioned, I mean, this is something that you didn't know about that was largely forgotten. Before we talk about what it is, I'm curious to get your thought primarily as to why. How did this body of laws, as it were, this phrase, simply disappear?
The advocates of the network utility, who were the leading computer scientists of the mid-1960s, were dead wrong in their short-term vision of the evolution of computing. It turned out that they thought the computer industry was going to be a set of big, centralized, public utility-like computer time-sharing terminals. And what happened just a few years later in the early 1970s was the internet instead, based on distributed personal computers and a decentralized network, one out instead. The punchline, though, which is part of what the paper is about, is while they were wrong in their short-term vision, and therefore their discussions have been forgotten, it turns out that in the long run they were absolutely prescient and absolutely right, and did an amazing job of describing the internet and communications landscape of today.
And that's what we're going to pick up right after this break. You're listening to KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know that it's on KZSU, and KZSU is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Again, underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu. Or you can go to our webpage at kzsu.stanford.edu and click on Donate to KZSU. Either way, we hope you continue to listen to the station and listen to Hearsay Culture. Kevin, let's talk about this idea. So the network utility comes out of this forgotten body of law that in its inception may have gotten what I think you're describing, the basic structure wrong, but actually got it the functionality, perhaps, of technology right. So what does this law teach us today? You mentioned a couple of cases in the article. We don't have to get into detail about the cases unless you think it's necessary, but what lessons do we take from this body of law?
Well, let me take a step back first. My view has always been in thinking about technology and policy that we need to understand the law, but we also need to understand the technology very deeply. And both sides tend to often make the mistake. I often hear people in the computer industry or engineers who don't quite appreciate, for example, the mechanics of an FCC rulemaking process and make incorrect statements about FCC decisions. Conversely, I talk to lots of people in Washington, D.C., who have a very poor understanding of the engineering underpinnings of the internet and communications networks. And so I've always tried to bring them together. And the computer utility is fascinating to me because it was a legal regulatory concept, but particularly it was a technology concept. So it was the way that computer scientists talked about communications and computing. And that became the basis for the way that the FCC was thinking about this issue. So the computer scientists had a notion that computers, which, remember, this is the mid-1960s, the ENIAC, the first programmable computer, was less than 20 years in the past. Computers were still these very rare, massive things that were used by the military and a few large companies. But they had a vision based on time sharing that individual people would get access to computers. And the way they would do it was over a communications network, because they would get access to these computers through terminals at their home or somewhere else that would have to tie in over the phone network to these big mainframes. And so they realized very quickly that the future of computing was going to come together with communications. And communications, as I've talked about, has been intensively regulated for a very long time. And therefore, the regulatory structure around communications networks was going to be essential to the future of the computer industry. That was the technological vision. Then what started to happen was, as these computer utility services started to grow, conflicts started to arise. So monopoly telephone companies, for example, refused to provide circuits to communication to computing service providers, but because they said, well, you're not a telephone company. Or they said, well, actually, what you're providing is a telephone service. It's a regulated communications service under the Communications Act. And because you're not registered and regulated as a telephone company, you can't provide it. Only we, at that point, AT&T and companies like Western Union, as regulated common carriers, can provide this connectivity service. We're not going to let you do it. So all these disputes started to come up, and the FCC in the mid-1960s realized that it needed to grapple with this issue. And so it started a proceeding in 1966 called the Computer Inquiry, which we now call Computer One, and which when I look back and did the historical research, there were all sorts of quotes from people saying, at the FCC saying, we think this is the most important proceeding the FCC has ever undertaken. And it was an effort to try to understand and come up with a set of rules governing computing invading the communications industry. And so that was the starting point of the process, and it became the beginning of a long series of proceedings at the FCC that stretched all the way into the late 1990s, and that were the foundation for the kind of regulatory disputes that we're having now.
And so it, in one of the focuses that you have in discussing this body of law, is the distinction which you've mentioned between computing and communications, and that this was a distinction that the FCC had to deal with. Can you describe that a little bit?
Running all the way through this debate from over now, talking about nearly 50 years, is a recognition that there are different categories. And there's a very well-developed set of definitions and rules for communication service, which is the stuff the FCC regulates under the statute. And then it became clear that there was this other stuff, computing, which in some ways looked like communications operationally, in that it was about moving bits around networks, and in some ways looked very different technically, in that it involved storage and processing and interactivity and different kinds of features. And from a business and economic standpoint, in some ways it was similar, in some ways it was different. And so the FCC, from the beginning, had to grapple with how do you classify this computing stuff? Because if they said it was a communications service, then they would have to regulate it, because that's what the congressional statute said. On the other hand, if they said it was something else, first of all, the question is, well, what's the something else, and what's the legal foundation for naming it something else? And then what does that mean? Do any rules apply? And more particularly, the question is not so much just do you regulate the computing providers, because the FCC, and this I talk about in the paper, in its proceeding in the 1960s, it said very clearly, look, we understand that we're not going to try to treat these little computer service providers as big monopoly phone companies. It just doesn't make sense to apply those rules. Very, very similar, again, to in the example I gave before, the way the FCC in the 90s said, we're not going to apply all the old rules to voice over IP just because it kind of looks like telephone service. And similarly with broadband, the FCC has said very clearly, we're not going to go and regulate search engines and social networking just because they have attributes that tie into communication. So the FCC said that, but that doesn't answer the hard question. And the hard question is, when the computer services, the data processing services, the information services, need interconnection with and access to the communication services to do what they do, then what? Because if your answer is the answer that the flip answer that a lot of people give, well, just keep it out, keep the regulation away from it, then that basically says let the communication service providers do whatever they want. Because they're subject to their existing rules. If this isn't something the FCC oversees, then it's not something the FCC can manage. Whereas my argument has been, and really the project that the FCC engaged in starting in the 1960s was designed to say, how do we figure out a role that fosters the growth and innovation of this new communications-based set of services without stifling it? So the head of the FCC, what was then called the Common Carrier Bureau at the time, had a quote where he said, this was again in the 1960s, we think of ourselves as marriage counselors. The computer and the phone are getting married, and it's our job to make it work. And I thought that was a beautiful analogy, and I think it's still appropriate today.
And it seems like that's been a somewhat rocky relationship.
That's why you need a marriage counselor. That's the point.
That's right. I guess there's a number of pithy questions I could ask after that, but I think I want to turn a little bit in the remaining time we have, and we have about 20 minutes left, and we're chatting with Professor Kevin Warbeck of the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. You discuss in this article, and at this point, given these issues, you can't discuss these issues without at least mentioning the cloud. And perhaps I'll ask you this jumping off question. You know, we have this phrase, cloud computing. What's your definition of it, and what does it add to our understanding of technology broadly?
Cloud is one of those things that everyone talks about, and you can't open up a technology publication without hearing about the cloud, how big it is, how important it is, and then you actually sit down and try to define it rigorously, it gets very hard. So, generally speaking, cloud computing is remote network-based storage and processing. So at some level, that's been around for a very long time. In fact, the genesis of it is this computer time-sharing that I'm talking about in the 1960s, which is, I'm getting ahead a little, but that's the thread that I draw. Basically, what people talk about today is the rise of these massive distributed data centers. For example, Google's platform, Amazon.com's platform, Apple's platform they're going to launch soon for cloud music, Microsoft's platform for cloud-based services. Thousands or even potentially close to millions of computers networked together that function as a virtual supercomputer and that provide remotely through the network services to end users as opposed to the processing happening entirely at the edge of the network at the user's computer. That's the general concept of cloud.
And does it add, given our understanding, and as you mentioned in the article and as you talked about, that we have these ideas going back decades, does using the phrase or naming something the cloud help us in any way?
I don't think it's important to answer that question because the names take root. So there's lots of debate about whether cloud is the right term and whether it's a good term. It's the term that gets used. What I think is important to understand is the evolution of computing. And this gets back to the story that I talk about in the paper. As I said earlier, there was a vision back in the 1960s that computing would evolve to become fundamentally networked and that it would be networked in a way where there would be massive hubs of centralized computing power that would then be connected over communications networks out to end users to provide services. And again, what happened instead was we got an internet model where we got the interconnection. The internet happened as a way of tying computers together, but it was radically decentralized. It was personal computers that did most of the processing, and the internet became this interface, this connection plane between those decentralized devices. Generally speaking, the technical dimension is a lot more complicated, but that's essentially what happened. What cloud means is, in a way, a re-centralization. It doesn't necessarily get rid of the PCs, although part of what we're seeing is the rise of device computing where you have less powerful devices at the edge of the network or even just sensors at the edge of the network that are tied in. But increasingly, services are leveraging massive central processing power. When you do a search on Google or use a mapping service or an online transcription or hundreds of things that we do on the internet today, the heavy lifting is happening far away by a distributed supercomputer. And that was the vision that these experts had back in the 1960s. And so understanding what that means, I think, is very important because that's a different architecture than the one that most people assumed and thought about when they developed both the legal structure around the internet in the 1990s, as well as the discourse and the understanding in communities and in business and talking about innovation and potential about the internet, was much more based on the notion of the internet as this fundamentally, inherently decentralizing force.
We're chatting with Professor Kevin Warbeck, who's at the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. You know, Kevin, we have about 15 minutes left. I want to push back a little bit on this idea of the name cloud being less important. And let me pose this concern to you and see what your reaction is. Word choice and semantics tend to be important in policymaking. If you call someone a hacker versus a security researcher, there are different reactions, right? The idea of piracy and the pirate, of course, has been a huge issue in copyright. If it's true that we've had these ideas going back for decades but didn't use this phrase cloud computing until recently, is it conceivable to you, and again, this is based upon your experience at the FCC and in lawmaking generally, is it conceivable to you that this using of the phrase could give the wrong impression, particularly to policymakers, which is that this is something new, when in fact it is not?
That's a good point, and you're certainly right that words matter, and so I don't want to say that they're unimportant in terms of shaping opinions and shaping decisions. The challenge is this is something new and something old, and that's not particularly surprising because when you look seriously at technology, that's always the case. So we always want to be these sort of techno-essentializers where we look and say, oh my God, everything's new, it's cool, it's different, nothing like this has happened before. And then the historians go back and say, well, no, actually, go and look at the literature from the Victorian age about the telegraph. And it looks exactly like the internet. That's interesting. And just as I said, I think we need to constantly understand the intersection of technology and law. We need to understand the intersection of what's new today with what we can draw on the past. And again, that in terms of this particular paper that I wrote, it's partly an appreciation of the value of a historical project to influence policymaking. It's not to say that everything is the same as the 1960s in the internet. Of course it isn't. It's to say that we can understand the present better by appreciating the extent to which these issues have been thought about and dealt with in the past, and to understand where our current conundrums actually come from. So I think though that you do raise a good point in terms of the policy discourse, that it's easy for legislators, other policymakers to get misled. Definitely it's important in advocacy of certain kinds of outcomes to understand how to describe things and explain them in a way that's not misleading. The point I was making was just that we don't typically have the choice about which words get used. We can try and shape the language, and this of course is something that happens a lot in politics where, for example, the conservatives prefer to talk about the death tax instead of the inheritance tax, and they've had some success with that. But in the realm of technology policymaking and understanding technology, again, cloud computing is the term that has taken hold. That's what all the analysts use. That's what all the companies use. So I think we need to explain what it means effectively. It's not, I think, particularly productive to say, well, let's not call it cloud computing. Let's call it computer utility, because that's what someone said in the 1960s, because you get a lot of people just scratching their heads.
Right. With that structure, and I'll accede to the will of the masses and use the phrase cloud computing. In the third part of your article, you talk about what you can see as the network utility agenda, and you raise four concerns: connectivity, capacity and robustness, data integrity and privacy, and transparency. We have about 10 minutes left, and so I'm certainly not going to ask you to cover each one, but I want to drill down particularly on transparency, because it's an issue that I'm particularly interested in. I write about it. It's something we discuss a lot on Hearsay Culture, but also because I think it gets to these core regulatory issues that we face today. These concerns that you have, particularly involving transparency, I think center around these questions of how these decisions are being made. So perhaps you could talk about transparency in a little more detail in the context of the concerns that you have going forward for dealing with these problems of the network utility.
Sure. And I'd certainly invite any of your listeners who are interested in the nitty gritty details, as there's a lot of them. This is an 80-page law review article, to go download the article from my website at warbeck.com, or for legal scholars on the SSRN repository. And would love to follow up with anyone on more specifics. But transparency, I agree, is really important. There are two particular concepts of transparency that are worth distinguishing. One is transparency in the policymaking process, so transparency of how decisions get made. The other, which is really more what I focus on in the paper, is transparency with regard to the network itself. Just briefly to say, the first one is incredibly important, and I've been involved, as you noted at the outset, with the Obama administration, the whole open government initiative, the work that's going on within the FCC, which is very exciting, about making the FCC more transparent, is extraordinarily important and frankly hasn't gotten enough credit. And I set up the first FCC website in the mid-1990s, and even though I'm not a professional web designer and I was not particularly good at web design in 1995, That code was largely the basis of the FCC website until a couple weeks ago. That is a real problem. I have no pride of authorship. The FCC for a long time was kind of asleep at the switch in terms of updating its own technology infrastructure. They just flipped the switch on a new website, which is wonderful, which provides lots of access to raw data sets and other information that's useful for people to understand the FCC. So I'd encourage people to go to FCC.gov to look and provide feedback on what they're doing. But to get back to transparency in the network utility context, as I said, to understand how to make good policy about networks, you need to understand networks. And to understand networks, you need to understand the guts of how they operate. And one great challenge, it turns out, with the internet is that we don't have good enough data about what's actually happening on operational networks. And the reason that's the case, part of it harkens back to this challenge that I've talked about in the paper. We made a sharp distinction between communications and computing. And we appropriately said we're not going to regulate the computing stuff under all the old traditional telephone rules. But we never quite got back to the process of thinking about how the regulatory process can help facilitate the coming together and the growth of this network of networks. And one way that it can is by ensuring that there's good data for researchers and policymakers to make decisions. So when we talk, for example, about things like network neutrality, it's easy for someone to say, well, companies need to manage their networks because otherwise there's going to be congestion and the internet will fall apart because it will overload. That may or may not be true. That's a technical statement. And it's a testable proposition in particular cases if we have data about what's going on in the network. It turns out there's very little data that's not controlled by individual companies. We used to, when the internet backbone was controlled by the National Science Foundation, have lots of data they required to be reported. That all went away. And companies generally are very secretive, for example, about their terms of peering, the terms and conditions under which they interconnect networks to networks. And my argument is that's a real problem. And the reason to provide the data is not to get access to anyone's privacy, and it's not necessarily for government to come in with a heavy hammer of regulation. It's to make good surgical decisions about regulation based on a better understanding of how networks operate. So that argument in that part of the paper is that we need a much broader conception of network transparency. I should say the FCC and its open internet rules that it adopted in December has transparency as one of the key principles for an open internet. So I have some hope that things will move in that direction.
You mentioned the Open Government Initiative, and that is something that in the remaining couple of minutes I would like to talk to you about. In terms of where it is today, you know, it's been recently under some threat with the budget discussions in Congress, where a number of the major e-government initiatives were threatened to be shut down, including data.gov and others. Where do you see the Open Government Initiative going in the next couple of years, especially as we head into another presidential election round? What do you expect to see happening in terms of increasing or decreasing or staying the same as far as where we are transparency right now?
Well, I think opening up government using technology will be one of the most important legacies of the Obama administration in this domain, and they won't get credit for it. And in fact, in many ways, they get criticized for it. But it's something that's going to be sustaining because, again, when you have information that then guides both policymaking as well as advocacy on the outside, and the philosophy of making the information available, not necessarily just for a particular purpose to communicate what the government is doing, but to let people take it, remix it, get access to APIs, go and build on top of it, hack on top of it, as we know from the technology world, is extraordinarily powerful. It's dismaying to see some of the funding potentially on the block, especially given just how little we're talking about. It's a minuscule amount of money that's involved, and it's a classic investment of a little bit of money up front that then is repaid many times over in terms of the level of private sector activity it catalyzes. But I think really we have a choice. And the fundamental choice, I think there only are two good answers about what we think about government. Either we want to make government better or we want to kill it. And I think the attitude that we want to kill it is totally unrealistic and wrong. and tends to masquerade as an argument against the excesses of government, which are absolutely real, but is about diagnosing the problem and not really being serious about the solution. And when I was involved with the transition team at the beginning of the Obama administration, looking at what had happened in the Bush administration, it was truly dismaying the number of cases where the goal was not a different policy outcome. I really have no problem with someone saying, I disagree with you on the issues. The goal was just to break government, because the assumption was government is inherently bad. If we just make it not work effectively, then good things will happen. And we know that's not the case. That wasn't the case with BP and the oil spill. That wasn't the case with Hurricane Katrina. That hasn't been the case time and time again. What we want to do is make government work better. So I think the open government initiative, the way that it is being fairly quietly pushed out down into government. So, for example, it's not just data.gov. It's as I described, what the FCC is doing in its own agency. That will be enduring. And I think at this point it's too late to stop it. But I think it's very important for people across the political spectrum. Even, again, if you disagree with the Obama administration's policies, I don't see how you can disagree with the argument that government should work better and be more open in the information that it provides to the American people.
Kevin, as far as upcoming projects, I ask this of active people like you, what are you working on now? What can we look forward to coming soon?
What I'm working on now is actually in a very different domain. So I've worked for a long time on this issue of the intersection of the FCC and the internet, and I'm sure I will come back to it. But I've actually been looking at a very different dimension about this network age that I talked about, how new phenomena arise in a fundamentally connected environment, which is actually looking at digital games, looking at video games. And the rise of this massive set of industries around games, how it's changing the nature of business and potentially influencing public policy, and specifically how we can take learnings and elements from games and from what they teach us and what they learn from psychology and apply them both to strategic business questions as well as to social impact and public policy goals. So in some ways, a very different area, but it has a number of touch points to the other work that I've done in the past, and something that I think is very exciting.
Professor Kevin Werbach, Associate Professor of Legal Studies and Business Ethics at the Wharton School, University of Pennsylvania. Kevin, thank you for joining us today on the show, and thanks for your candor in analyzing these issues. Again, the article is The Network Utility, which, as Kevin mentioned, you can get off SSRN or by going to werbach.com. That's werbach.com. Kevin, thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture, and I invite you back once that project is further along to discuss it in more detail.
Thanks a lot, Dave. It's been fun.
I'm excited to mention a number of guests that are coming up on Hearsay Culture, guests not only for this quarter, but indeed coming up in the summer quarter on Hearsay Culture. The summer quarter will begin at the end of June, so we will be in interim on KZSU's schedule in June. But among the guests that are coming up, among the people that we can look forward to hearing from, are going to be... And I guess I should say we have one more show this semester before we get to the summer. Coming up on May 31st, I'll be Professors Andy Hiley and Scott Gaylord, my colleagues at Elon University School of Law, discussing their work involving taxation of sales on the internet. And then coming up this summer, a number of guests I'm very excited about. Among them, Kevin Kelly of Wired Magazine, author of What Technology Wants, Andrew Renz, a research associate at the Center for the Study of the Public Domain at Duke Law School, as well as Professor Michael Risch of Villanova University School of Law, discussing his work on patents, and some guests that I have booked over the last couple of weeks, and I'm excited to mention now, Professor Peter Gallison of Harvard University, discussing his documentary Secrecy, Professor Susan Shirk of the University of California, San Diego, editor of the book Changing Media, Changing China, Professor Helen Nissenbaum of New York University, discussing her recent work as well as her book Privacy and Content. context. Professor Akarn Fung of the JFK School of Government at Harvard discussing transparency and technology. And Professor Marcus Boone of York University discussing his book, In Praise of Copying. As always, there are a number of ways you can get Hearsay Culture that you can listen to it. The main way is to listen to the show live on KZSU Tuesdays at 4:30 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU. And that's a time that may stay the same for the summer quarter. Remains to be seen. But that's our time this quarter. You can also get the show via podcast. You can get the show three ways. Either by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get not only all of the previous shows, but as well as you can look at the upcoming schedule and also offer any comments and feedback through the webpage. You can also get the show by going to Stanford Center for Internet Society's iTunes page, where you can get not only Hearsay Culture, but any other events that have occurred at CIS. And lastly, you can also get the show by going to CIS's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, feedback, thoughts, ruminations at dave@hearsayculture.com. Thank you for listening to the show today. I hope you've enjoyed it. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.